This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, The evils are gone away from me. Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei slams what he calls the arrogant tone of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. The European Union hits 19 Venezuelans with sanctions over legislative elections. Caracas says the move shows the bloc's frustration at its failure to change the government. Authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say millions still face disrupted water supplies following freezing weather conditions last week. Top story: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution is slammed as arrogant. The tone of the U.S. and the three European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also denounced the West for failing to fulfill its commitments under the accord. In the meantime, Iran has announced the termination of its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Here's a report.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Political commentator Frank Emspach says Iran has made it clear that it will not be pushed around by the United States.
If the United States is going to re-enter the agreement, the conditions sort of have to be there for it. President Biden can't look like he's caving into Iran, and of course Iran has made it very clear they're not going to be pushed around by the United States. So what steps can be taken to allow the countries to come together? Well, one of them was obviously over this weekend, where the European Commission or some group of Europeans was pretty clear, I think, the United States, that enough was enough and that we should try to find a way to move forward. Here in this country, the Iranian issue is not front and center at this point. Nobody is banging the drum here except some very small section of, at the moment, I would say the Clinton wing of the State Department. But by and large, the focus is on the disaster in Texas and, of course, the stimulus package. So foreign policy issues are not front and center. And in a certain sense, that gives Biden enough breathing room, perhaps, to make the moves necessary.
The European Union has imposed new sanctions against Venezuela over the country's December legislative elections. The new sanctions target 19 Venezuelan officials, lawmakers, and members of security forces. The EU accuses the sanctioned individuals of undermining the opposition's electoral rights, violating human rights, and restricting fundamental freedoms. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arriaza has criticized the EU, saying the sanctions are based on false arguments about honorable citizens. He said the sanctions indicate that the EU is frustrated at its failure to change the government in Venezuela. The West claims that December's legislative election was rigged in favor of the party of President Nicolas Maduro, an allegation Caracas rejects as baseless. An independent review of the 2019 chokehold death of a black man in the U.S. city of Aurora says police officers had no legal basis to stop, frisk, and use lethal force on the victim. The report says police investigators failed to ask the three officers involved in the death of 23-year-old Elijah McClain basic and critical questions whether their force was justified. The unarmed African-American was held down for 15 minutes and then given 500 milligrams of a sedative by paramedics. He suffered cardiac arrest and died after 3 days. The investigation said the paramedics failed to properly examine McClain and injected him with, quote, a grossly inaccurate dose. McClain's death then sparked fresh fury over police brutality in the U.S. just months after George Floyd's death, another black man who died in police custody. And authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say millions still face disrupted water supplies following freezing weather conditions last week. The record-breaking freeze knocked out power stations in Texas. Authorities said as of Monday evening, more than 1,200 public water systems reported disruptions in service due to the weather. They said that affected more than 7.9 million people. In the state's biggest city, Houston, thousands lined up for hours at a food distribution center to get food and drinking water. The U.S. southern state has been hit by an unprecedented winter storm that caused widespread blackouts. The storm claimed the lives of at least 24 people in Texas. Spanish protesters have clashed with police during a fresh rally over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél. Protesters in Barcelona were met by lines of riot police and police vans. They threw bottles and other objects at law enforcers. They also made barricades out of rubbish bins and set them ablaze. This was a seventh night of clashes after the rapper was jailed for allegedly glorifying terrorism and insulting royalty. Hasél is known for his anti-establishment raps. His nine-month sentence has prompted debate over freedom of expression in the country. Several people have been injured and dozens detained since demonstrations began in Barcelona and several other cities. Russia has criticized the European Union for imposing new sanctions on the country over the Navalny case, calling the measure unlawful and a cause of disappointment. The Russian Foreign Ministry said the sanctions were prepared under a far-fetched pretext. It added that the bloc had missed an opportunity to change its course with regards to Russia. On Monday, the European Union agreed to impose sanctions on four Russian officials in response to the jailing of opposition figure Alexei Navalny.
In response to events around the situation of Mr. Navalny, we reached a political agreement to impose restrictive measures against those responsible for his arrest and sentencing and persecution. And for doing that, for the first time ever, we will make use of the European Union global human rights regime to this end.
Two EU diplomats said no names were discussed when the bloc's foreign ministers agreed on the sanctions, but they said the bans are likely to hit Russia's director of prisons and prosecutor general, among others. Earlier, Moscow called on other countries, including the US and the EU nations, to stay out of Navalny's case, calling it an internal issue. The Kremlin critic lost an appeal against his three-year prison conviction this week. He was detained on February the 2nd for violating a 2014 parole, a charge it denies. After imposing a grueling months-long lockdown over the coronavirus outbreak, the UK government has announced a gradual easing of social restrictions, signifying perhaps that the country's vaccine program has started to bear fruit. But as Saeed Purazar reports, with thousands of people still in hospital with the illness and the efficacy of the vaccine yet to be proven, the government is urging everyone to not throw caution to the wind.
The highly anticipated February 22nd announcement is finally here, marking what the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls his roadmap out of lockdown, following pressure from members of his own Conservative Party to explain how he plans to reopen the country.
We cannot persist indefinitely with restrictions that debilitate our economy, our physical and mental well-being, and the life chances of our children.
But restrictions won't be lifted in one fell swoop. Measures will be conditional based on four tests, with the government set to examine the data at each stage before unlocking further.
One of the first places to reopen, schools, which the Prime Minister, not long ago, described as potential vectors of transmission, causing the virus to spread between households.
In the devolved nations of Wales and Scotland, pupils have already gone back to school. We asked a number of parents in London what they thought of their kids returning to classrooms.
Well, they've lost nearly a year of schooling, so they definitely need to get back to school.
As long as people are sensible and the schools, I think they've taken all the necessary measures to keep the children safe, then I'll be glad for him to go back to school.
There is still some risk involved, I suppose, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the vaccination program is going forward, and I hope this decision is supported by data.
Critics, among them leader of the opposition Labour Party, have criticized the government for missing the opportunity to jab the teachers and school staff.
If we'd used that last half term, that last week, to vaccinate teachers and school staff, we'd be having a better discussion about children back to school. But ideally on the 8th, I'll listen to what the Prime Minister says this afternoon. I hope he's got a good plan.
The government says it does, and that it hasn't vaccinated teachers and school staff for a reason.
There isn't strong evidence that teachers are more likely to catch COVID than any other group, because children are very, very rarely get symptoms or serious illness from the disease. The value, the importance of vaccinating children is to try to stop the spread of the disease.
At the moment, although death and infection numbers have gone down, there are still almost 20,000 people in British hospitals with COVID-19, and it's going to take months before everyone gets their first jab. It remains to be seen if this is indeed the beginning of the end for lockdowns in this country. Saeed Purazar, London.
Anti-coup protesters have held new rallies in Myanmar despite a heavy security presence by the army. People hit the streets in the largest city, Yangon, demanding their civilian leaders be reinstated. They also won the release of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other officials from detention. 3 protesters have been killed and nearly 700 others arrested since anti-coup demonstrations began earlier this month. The army has warned that confrontation could cost lives. Meanwhile, a civil disobedience campaign against military rule has continued. Myanmar's junta leaders seized power on February the 1st. They alleged fraud in November's elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. A report has emerged that suggests the head of a controversial U.S. security firm, who is a close ally of the former President Donald Trump, had violated a U.N. arms embargo on Libya. The report has excited speculation that the 2019 arms exports to the African country might have been carried out on Washington's orders.
Another controversy for the private U.S. security firm, Blackwater. A confidential UN report says Eric Prince, the company's founder and former head, has violated an arms embargo on Libya by sending mercenaries and weapons to support Libyan renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The report, obtained by the New York Times, details how Mr. Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, deployed heavily armed foreign troops to eastern Libya to assist Khalifa Haftar in the heat of an attack to capture Tripoli in 2019. According to the UN, the $80 million operation included plans for the mercenaries to assassinate selected Libyan commanders. The report raises questions about possible ties between the operation and the Trump administration. Prince did not cooperate with the UN investigation and has rejected having anything to do with the military operations in Libya. However, the report exposes him to possible UN sanctions.
Well, it's all the same thing, that it broke the law and that he was told to do it. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference. In fact, the laws, or international law and laws, are meaningless to the United States. And in 2011, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing to destroy the Libyan government and the government there, and for regime change, that was against international law, but it didn't mean so. They break international law all the time when they level sanctions against countries. These are violations of international law, and so, you know, that's, it's par for the course. It's very telling, though, that they would be doing this use of mercenaries.
Since 2014, two rival seats of power have emerged in Libya, namely the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and another group based in the eastern city of Tobruk, supported militarily by Haftar's troops.
Well, the UN report is another in the long list of scandals private U.S. security firm Blackwater has been involved in. The most notable was an incident in 2007 in Iraq when 4 Blackwater security personnel killed 14 civilians, including children. But Blackwater is most notably known for the use of mercenaries in U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even more notable are the ties between the firm and the U.S. government. The UN report on Libya describes an attempt that is reminiscent of Washington's habit of seeking to overthrow governments through hired guns, a strategy that hasn't been much successful as of late.
The damning 120-page UN report on Blackwater's contract in Libya was another instance of military intervention by Washington-linked private security companies in the internal affairs of countries around the world. In recent years, there has been a surge in the activity of guns for hire in countries like Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Some of the mercenaries have capabilities and equipment on par with elite U.S. troops. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations. Back in May, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, 2 of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro.
We had a casual conversation, I guess you could call it a verbal contract, giving me some vague mission guidelines on training Venezuelans coming here and putting Maduro on a plane.
The two said they had been working with Jordan Goodrow, an American military veteran who leads a Florida-based security company called Silvercorp USA.
measures that the United States will take for regime change to advance their interests. Very obscene, immoral measures are revealed all the time. The reason why they like to use mercenaries in a lot of these things and what they do, and then the academy, or this group that used to be Blackwater, got its notoriety for doing things that gave the United States plausible denial.
The involvement of the U.S.-backed troops in these countries wasn't the first, and certainly won't be the last. But does the growing number of operations indicate that the U.S. is opting for a more indirect means of intervening in other nations' affairs?
Well, that's your war news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him by means of indignation. name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound effect on those living with obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD. Whilst large-scale studies are hard to come by, smaller data sets from Europe show between a third and half of those suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, had symptoms worsened during the coronavirus pandemic. This can be especially problematic for people whose OCD was already focused on cleanliness. We now present you an article authored by Matilda Bosley. The piece is titled, How COVID is a Double-Edged Sword for Those with OCD. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Matilda Bosley's article. Luca Buchanan has always been consumed by the fear of contamination and germs, washing their hands until they were raw and terrified the food they ate would poison them. Diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD at the age of 19, Buchanan, who uses they or them pronouns, spent years in therapy telling themselves over and over that there was nothing to fear, that the chances of a global contagion were minuscule, and that they weren't infected and dangerous to those around them. Buchanan says, I have to tell myself over and over there's no justification for the levels of compulsions that I'm having about cleanliness. Then last March, Luca Buchanan's worst fears came true. Suddenly, it's like, oh yeah, I was right. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound effect on those living with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. While large-scale studies are hard to come by, smaller data sets from Europe show between a third and half of those suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, had symptoms worsened during the coronavirus pandemic. This can especially be problematic for people like Buchanan, whose OCD was already focused on cleanliness. The Perth, Australian native says, I could physically feel the germs on me, but then I kind of wasn't really able to rationalize it, because at that point we didn't know much about the virus. He added, obsessive compulsive disorder loves doubt and uncertainty, and because there was a lot of uncertainty, it really did trigger me in a big way. Dr. James Collett, a psychologist at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, says although it was necessary from a public health standpoint, much of the government messaging around COVID-19 has been problematic for those with obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD. Dr. James Collett says, the obsessions don't occur at random. They're connected to the person's worries, adding, the COVID messaging is saying that, yeah, there are germs out there, and yes, you might hurt someone severely by spreading germs without even knowing it. People are really internalizing this, even saying it's cementing their OCD. And for clinicians, these messages have been difficult to combat. Dr. James Collett says, a client with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, saying, I was right all along, well, that's actually pretty hard to argue with right now. Adding, for clients that were previously experiencing washing-type symptoms, we're seeing reduced social interaction and greater interpersonal conflicts as well. But this fear hasn't been universal. For Luca Buchanan's friend, Kai, the pandemic has had the opposite effect. Kai, who asked for his last name not to be included, says, I've had obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, pretty much my entire life, and as a result, I've always felt a lot of shame about it because of my behavior. Kai's OCD is also focused on germs and cleanliness. He always carries hand sanitizers. He washes his hands before every meal, and whenever possible, he likes to keep a safe distance between himself and other people and their possible germs. He laughs. Those are now just standard practices that everybody does, adding, it's made it a lot easier to go out and have a social life because people don't automatically notice that I have this mental illness. That takes a lot of the shame away. Kai says in the first days of the coronavirus pandemic, he was terrified that the global panic would make his anxiety and compulsions even worse, but this never came to pass. He says, the world hasn't felt any more scary than it did before. The level of anxiety that a lot of people who don't have obsessive compulsive disorder are now feeling about getting sick, that's just the way my brain works all the time. He added, a lot of us in online OCD support groups have been joking about how we have been preparing for this all of our lives. But Dr. James Collett says the increased awareness about cleanliness and staying at home may make it more difficult to identify people who are struggling with undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. He says, because of COVID-19, we may need to actually raise the threshold of the OCD diagnosis, adding, in the past, if someone was washing their hands every time they touched something in public or something like that, we might say, oh, that's a bit of a worry, maybe vulnerable to OCD. Now we might actually be saying, oh yeah, that's normal, understandable behavior. Dr. James Collett continues, we might actually find that where our ability to detect those OCD symptoms is actually a bit off in terms of just differentiating it from normal, healthy behavior now. For both Kai and Luca Buchanan, this newfound permission to take cleanliness seriously is a double-edged sword. Luca Buchanan has worked for years to reduce the number of times they wash their hands each day. Now there is a sign in every shop reminding them to wash again. They say, I have to be really strict to only wash my hands for those 20 seconds, adding, if you could think of it like an addiction, there's no such thing as having a little bit of it because it just unlocks the gates. It feels so good to use those compulsions to quell the anxiety. I just struggle with what is actually too much. Before the coronavirus pandemic, one of Kai's main goals was to press the pedestrian button on street corners with his hands. He says, as I was starting to get to a point where I could do that, the rules changed, and now the ones in Perth have stickers on them saying, bump with your elbow, which is what I was doing before, adding, I'm back to square one. The more years I've reinforced the behavior, the harder it is to undo it. They become cemented in your brain. Attention is now turning to how to help those with obsessive-compulsive disorder transition out of the pandemic state of mind once vaccines become widespread. Dr. James Collett says there's a real worry about people having difficulty unlearning these behaviors that are appropriate during COVID pandemic. He says this easing period may be the most crucial in identifying people who may have been suffering from unnoticed dysfunctional behaviors throughout the pandemic. He says, I think the real message is we need to reach out to people who were perhaps seeming a bit more withdrawn, or they're still really invested in things that are starting to look like ritual patterns of behavior. Despite the increased anxiety, Luca Buchanan has found a lot of comfort in society's new obsession with hygiene. Buchanan says, I love the fact that I would go into a restaurant and they would have plexiglass things in front of the counter. Suddenly, everyone sitting 1.5 meters apart in public transport. Oh God, that's my dream. But they know this won't last forever. They said, I really hope this hygienic awareness just remains as like a post-COVID world, adding, but I'll live with obsessive-compulsive disorder for the rest of my life, so the world is going to keep changing, and I'll just have to try and make it work, I guess.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, president of Egypt, and former fighter, the prime minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want
of
the United
law.
States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then president of the United States, told Eben that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eben. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. Forty-5 minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. The Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldbeck asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the UN. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the U.S. On October the 6th, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to prepare for the festival, they were hit by surprise attacks on two fronts of Sinai and the Golan Heights, the same areas occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. Inevitably, the Israeli tanks started attacking, but the Egyptians had thought about that too. The Sagar anti-tank missile made Sinai a graveyard for Israeli tanks. Sagar anti-tank guided missiles were again the result of Egyptian friendship with the Soviet Union. In the first 36 hours of the war, half of the 300 Israeli tanks stationed in Sinai were destroyed. But at the same time, the conflict started on the northern front in the Golan Heights on Syrian territory. Six hours later, the Israeli firing line was broken and Syrian tanks were close to the Jordan River. That night, the southern half of the Golan Heights was captured by the Syrians. Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, David El-Azhar, announced at a news conference that the Israeli counterattack had begun.
This morning, we started our counterattack, and we shall break and destroy completely all the attacking forces.
Sinai Desert witnessed Israelis' heavy losses again. The fact was that Israel had lost the ability to resist on both the eastern and northern fronts. El-Azhar had to choose a front for his forces to concentrate on. The Egyptians had advanced in the Sinai Desert, but they still saw the desert for miles before their eyes. But Assyrians had advanced to the banks of the Jordan River and were not far from the villages and towns bordering Israel. So El-Azhar prepared the concentration of forces on the Golan Heights. In the night of October the 8th, 1973, Israeli tanks reached Syrian positions in the Golan Heights, but the Soviet Union's modern infrared night combat equipment inflicted horrific casualties on the Zionists. The Israelis knew that defeat on the Golan Heights could come at a heavy price. Destruction. October the 10th, the Israelis took control of the Golan Heights and their tanks forced the Syrians to retreat. The Israelis were now just 30 kilometers from Damascus. Hafez al-Assad asked Sadat to do something to take the pressure off the Syrians. At this point, Anwar al-Sadat made a serious and decisive decision. He ordered his troops stationed in the Sam missile line in the east of the Suez Canal to go to nearby heights in the Sinai Desert. But to reach these heights, the tanks had to leave the area covered by Sam missiles. This operation marked one of the largest tank battles in history. Israeli tanks with better strategic positions targeted the Egyptian tanks. The Egyptians' tanks, on the other hand, were out of the safe zone of Sam missiles, and the Israeli fighters could attack them easily. Egyptian tanks were destroyed, but the Zionists lost only 20 tanks. The war reached its critical moment. Israel had stopped its enemies, but could no longer resist. Finally, Golda Meir's plans had worked. Golda Meir had called for immediate assistance from the United States from the beginning of the war and after Israel's successive defeats on the East and North fronts. As a result, on October 15, 1973, the largest arms shipment in history was sent to Israel, as ordered by President Nixon. Israel benefited from this flood of arms in the war.
But there was no doubt in my mind, no doubt in Henry Kissinger's mind, as to what we should do. Israel had to be saved.
One of Israel's most brutal military commanders was called up after the arrival of American weapons. The man who knew the Sinai Desert very well. Ariel Sharon. To go over the Suez Canal, he decided to open a canal to the west coast of the Suez Canal between the two divisions guarding it. Egyptians did not take care of the area near Lake Al-Moura due to the greater width of the lake than other parts of the canal. And there was a distance of about a mile between the watchful forces in the north and south of the canal. Israelis could have dominated the Egyptians by crossing this route from behind. But something was wrong. Sharon did not think about the talent of the Egyptian forces stationed near Lake Al-Moura. The Israeli forces entered the canal at night, but most of them clashed with the Egyptians because the Egyptians near the lake were more powerful than what Sharon had imagined, so only a few of them were able to cross the canal. A year before, when the Israelis had thought of such a day, they had built a 180-meter-long bridge just across the Suez Canal in such a situation. It took 3 days to install the bridge. On October the 19th, when the bridge was completely installed, the Egyptians were astonished. Israeli tanks crossed the bridge and took up positions on the west coast of the Suez Canal, just behind the Egyptians. Egypt opened heavy fire on the Israelis, but the Israelis were thinking of only one thing, the Sabra rocket launchers. The Suez sky became safe for Israeli fighters when Sam missiles were targeted by Israeli tanks. The flood of American weapons of the Israeli army engulfed the Egyptians. the Israelis began to advance into Egypt, and Anwar al-Sadat had no choice but to call a ceasefire. At that time, Egypt's powerful ally, the Soviet Union, played its role. The Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, who had previously shown his forces to the United States, threatened the U.S. with sending Soviet troops to the region if Washington did not agree to send a joint U.S.-Soviet peacekeeping force to the Middle East. The United States was almost certain that the Soviet Union would not send troops to the Middle East, but nevertheless prepared its nuclear weapons. And the Soviet Union were afraid of a nuclear war, and this fear brought peace back to the Middle East, and the ceasefire was reached on October the 25th to allow tired soldiers to retreat. But something happened that surprised Israel and even Sadat himself. When you are forced to do something, you will forget the Arabic zeal for not recognizing Israel. 4 years after the Yom Kippur War on November the 19th, 1977, after years of war between the Arabs and Israel, Anwar al-Sadat, who was no longer able to fight Israel, changed his way completely. He was the first Arab president to land at Ben Gurion Airport with U.S. support and spoke of reconciliation and peace at the Israeli Knesset.
Let us agree that whatever happens between us, we should solve it together through, talks rather than going to war.
But they had to have a meeting in a cozy place, Washington Northwest Road, on top of Jungle Hills, U.S. President's exclusive resort, Camp David. Days of secret talks at Camp David led to a treaty that was signed by both sides the following year in the open courtyard of the White House in Washington. Then U.S. President Jimmy Carter was happy and satisfied.
Provides for the full exercise of Egyptian sovereignty over the Sinai. It calls for the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Sinai. And after an interim withdrawal, which will be accomplished very quickly, the establishment of normal, peaceful relations between the two countries, including diplomatic relations.
Sadat recognized Israel, while Gamal Abdel Nasser and the rest of the Arab leaders said, no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel in the Khartoum summit. Instead, Israel returned the Sinai Desert to Egypt without the slightest conflict. Diplomatic relations were established between Egypt and Israel, and Israeli ships were able to cross the Suez Canal, the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Strait of Tiran freely. It seemed like a good deal. Sadat also won the World Peace Prize for his good deal and became the symbol of world reconciliation. But the last deal was not that good. 3 years later, on October the 6th, 1981, the Nobel Peace Prize winner was shot by a young man who was shouting, either death or compromise. On behalf of the Egyptian people and the Arabs who were dissatisfied with the peace between Egypt and Israel, Khalid Islamboli thanked Anwar al-Sadat for the deal with Israel.
the limelight.
The wealthy, privileged whites served by the Texas dominant political class are a small minority of the population. That's the ongoing legacy of conquest and colonialism, says Scott Kersish, university professor